American media is a business, and it has a mission. Not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with a capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive, it's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And it is a good day. This is Ryan Robson reporting to you from the Internet for Monday, July 25, 2011. And you are listening to Newsreel, the WOG Global sit-up on corporate legal tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today, and just by listening and distributing this program, you are too. Also standing up for your free speech, because he's a big old softy like that, is Misanthropic Gods.
Follow all these news stories and check our facts by going to the Rant Media forums and looking under Newsreel for a post with today's date. You get there by going to smf.rantradio.com. This would be a free podcast to be heard on Rant Radio Talk, Galaxy 15 Radio, and recorded live in Second Life every Thursday night at 7 p.m. SL time at Grid Archers 155-74666. What we need all of you right now to do is support us. If you have something to send us, please email us at news@rostudios.com. Also, if you like what you're listening to, please tell other people about it. We'd like to get more people listening. And who we have here today is Morph Sky Tower, A La Mode, GS Darkwatch, Legion Rosamund, and WPDK Resident.
I'd like to make a small correction there. It's rostudios.org, not .com. But we have some feedback here from that UFO story from last episode, from Fat Ninja. Sadly, I don't have a link for this. Tried to find it, but failed. I'll see what I can do later. Supposedly, the UFOs have done a little more than cut communications. A guest on the Coast to Coast AM, which of course take that with a grain of salt, claimed that UFOs are actually ruining the warheads by rendering the plutonium cores inert, as if they had sit in storage for so long they had exceeded their half-life, something that no known science can do, which is true. We don't actually have any way of accelerating radiometric decay. Of course, being that this is a guest, not a call-in person, was on Coast to Coast AM, a well-known conspiracy show, you have to take it with a grain of salt. Another point here on UFOs, the route I'm in is a bit of a UFO hotspot. Up, and for those who don't know, Fat Ninja drives the big rigs down, like, highway shipping freight and stuff like that, up and down western Tennessee. Usually these UFOs stand out as they don't perform like any conventional technology. Most of them hover silently without any apparent noise, nor do they seem to operate with any soft or lift surface air buoyancy device. If it weren't for the fact that I mostly see them at night, I'd probably have taken pictures by now. That was Fat Ninja. Now, of course, this is very interesting. If it turns out to be true that these UFOs are making the warheads go inert radioactively, like the radioactive substances no longer chain react, that's a big deal, because that's literally something we can't do. It doesn't happen in nature. We can't do it. So that would either mean that some really advanced technology is involved, someone's mistaken, which I personally think is the most likely one, or physics as we know it is fundamentally different than we thought before. So that's something to look into, and I hope he does find me some links on this, because I'd like to read up more about it, see if it's bullshit, or see if there actually is some kind of study behind it, see what's going on here. Okay, well, into the news. In transport tyranny news, court okays airport body scanners, rejects constitutional challenge. A federal appeals court on Friday unanimously declined to block the government from using intrusive body scanners across airports nationwide, saying it is not persuaded by any of the statutory or constitutional arguments against them. How can you not be persuaded by a constitutional argument? The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit was deciding a constitutional and procedural challenge on the advanced imaging technology, NUD, body scanners, which began rolling out in 2007 and are deployed in at least 78 airports nationwide. The Electronic Privacy Information Center asked the court to block usage of devices, of which 500 more are being rolled out this year, on the grounds that they are an unconstitutional privacy invasion, ineffective and unhealthy to airline passengers. Which I would say that's probably an unwarranted search, and the Constitution protects you people against that. The petitioners argue that using AIT for primary screening violates Fourth Amendment because it is more invasive than is necessary to detect weapons or explosives, the appeals court noted. As other circuits have held, and as the Supreme Court has strongly suggested, screening passengers at an airport is an administrative search because the primary goal is not to determine whether any passengers committed a crime, but rather to protect the public from a terrorist attack. The court said whether an administrative search is reasonable is a balancing test on how much it intrudes upon an individual's privacy, and how much intrusion is needed for the promotion of legitimate government interests. Well, to that first point there, this is an absolute invasion of someone's privacy because of the fact that it takes a picture of your naked body. I mean, other than asking you all your intimate secrets, I can't think of anything more invasive than that. The balance clearly favors the government here, the court ruled 3-0. The court added that an AIT scanner, unlike a magnetometer, is capable of detecting and therefore deterring attempts to carry aboard explosives in liquid powder form. Oh, bullshit, they miss things all the time with that. The three-judge appellate panel did not address limited research suggesting machines might not detect explosives or even guns taped to a person's body. So, they basically said that it detects these things, but they ignored any research saying that it doesn't detect these things. That's fair and unbiased right there. However, the appellate court, which is one step away from the Supreme Court, said that the Transport Security Administration breached federal law in 2009 when it formally adopted the airport scanners as the primary method of scanning. Judges said the TSA violated the Administrative Procedures Act for failing to have a 90-day public comment period and ordered the agency to undertake one. Generally, under the APA, agency decisions must go through what is often termed a notice and commitment period if there are new rules which substantially affect the rights of the public, in this case air passengers. The Environmental Protection Agency often undertakes notice and comment periods for proposed pollution regulations, and most government agencies that deal with the public on that scale do go through those kind of checks and balances. The court did not penalize the TSA for its shortcomings. The TSA argued to the court in March that the public comment period would thwart the government's ability to respond to ever-evolving threats. Judge Douglas Ginsburg, writing for the majority, said TSA must allow a 90-day notice and commitment period because of the new substantive obligations on airline passengers. It is clear that by producing an image of the unclothed passenger, an AIT scanner intrudes on his or her personal privacy in a way a magnetometer does not, which is a metal detector for those of you who don't know. Therefore, regardless of whether this is a new substantive burden or the change substantively affects the public to a degree sufficient to implicate the policy interests animating notice and comment rulemaking, Ginsburg wrote. Indeed, few, if any, regulatory procedures imposed directly and significantly upon so many members of the public. Not surprisingly, therefore, much public concern and media coverage has been focused on types of privacy, safety, and efficacy, each of which no doubt would have been the subject of many comments that had the TSA. This is more about that, so I'm just going to end it here.
You know, I think that this says a lot about the TSA, you know, is that they go on and on and on about how they're this, how they're that, and, you know, people have tried to get past these, and they have successfully, very easily. I believe I was reading one study that was done where literally if you just had something thin, you know, like a firearm, just on the side, on like your hip, perfectly flush with your body, it wasn't even able to pick it up. It just blended right into the background, you know? And again, this is just, you know, the fallout from the whole USA Patriot Act, which was actually just recently renewed this year, and, you know, all the rights that we've essentially thrown away since 9/11, all in the, you know, all in the auspices of preventing terrorism. And, you know, I have to admit, there have been some pretty amazing busts that they've been doing, you know, with the FBI and stuff like this. But TSA does more harm than good, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the studies I've seen, which I don't have any on hand right now, but they've shown that the scanners are no more effective than the old screening procedures, and in fact, often are less effective, just because of the fact that either the employees aren't trained enough to see what they're looking for, or they underestimate how good the machine is at spotting things and stuff like that. So it's much easier to get stuff passed than a metal detector, which will just go off if you're carrying something metal. And of course,
now, you see, again, it's the whole part of the issue is TSA is, like, they're hiring the least common denominators here. They're hiring people for really crappy wages, for doing really crappy jobs. I mean, really, who here wants to have a job where, you know, if somebody says that they don't want to have a picture taken of them, you know, while they're essentially naked, you have to feel them up, you know? I'm sorry, I don't want that job. You know, I'm bad enough as a security guard as is. You know, and then as an EMT, you know, cleaning up puke, that's no fun. But, you know, I don't have to fondle people's junk on a daily basis. And that's kind of where my hard limits are, you know. And the people that are doing it are going to be desperate. And the ones that are desperate really don't give a shit about their job if they're getting paid crap.
I also seen once, they were talking about the background checks they do on them. And the background checks were actually less than we get to be a regular uniformed security guard. Which means security guards don't have much authority. We can't just search people. The most we can do to someone, and only in extreme situations, is actually arrest them. And the TSA, they don't even have the same, they just have a basic background check. And so, they get to strip search people, so they're finding, like, people who have had convictions years ago in these positions kind of thing, because the fact is slipped through the basic background. And of course, it's totally ineffective, because most of the recent terrorist attack attempts were stopped by passengers on the plane, and increased awareness, When the passengers realized something bad was going on, they did something about it. So, personally, I think they should dump all this money that they're using for these scanners and dump it into air marshals. Plainclothes people on airplanes who are trained to deal with these situations, so when they come up, you have someone on the plane who can deal with it. I think that's better than trying to stop everyone getting on the plane, because the moment someone gets on a plane, if there's no check and balances on the plane, you're screwed. They're in control.
You know, and the thing is, these guys are, the air marshals are armed, you know, and they're right there on the planes. Because like you said, they're trained to deal with this stuff. You know, you start increasing the air marshals, you know, it might take up a seat or two, but in my opinion, it's worth it, you know? And I'm a little bit wary of having, you know, armed people, you know, walking around, you know, that, you know... No, actually, I don't. I don't have a problem with that. What the hell am I saying? But I have no problem with armed people walking around. Hell, I think that we should allow citizens to carry guns on the damn planes.
But that's never going to happen, so let's just get some uniformed armed people on the planes, and that should be good enough for now. I mean, the attacks aren't very common, and usually they're done by people who aren't very skilled. They focus all their efforts on getting stuff onto the plane and not so much what they're going to do once they're on the plane. So, I mean, passengers taking these guys down before, a trained officer should have no problem dealing with this. And in criminalizing customers' news... So press report found busted pirate site users were good customers. Surprise, surprise. In June, police across several countries raided the operators of streaming video links portal Kino.to. The massive operation was one of the largest of its type, and site admins and users alike were branded enemies of the TV and movie business. However, it now appears that in respect of the latter group, the opposite was found to be true. The June raids against Kino.to, which involved as many as 250 police and other authorities, dwarfed even the 2006 raids against the Pirate Bay. Following the events, the Kino.to website displayed notices which stated they had been closed on suspicion of forming a criminal organization to commit professional copyright infringement. While noting that several operators of the site had been arrested, it had also criticized the site's users. Yeah, internet users who illegally pirated or distributed copies of films may be subjected to a criminal prosecution, read the warning. But were the site's users all criminals hell-bent on destroying the movie industry? According to a report from Telopolis, whatever that word is, a recent study found the reverse was true. The study, which was carried out by the Society for Consumer Reports, GFK, found that the users of pirate sites, including Kino.to, did not find the copyright lobby painted stereotype of parasites who take and never give back. In fact, the study also found that internet users treat these services as a preview, as a kind of try before you buy. Which, how many of us here can say that, you know, there's a movie we weren't sure about or some music we never heard before, we downloaded it, we listened, we liked, we bought. I mean, it's better than just buying everything you come across. This, the survey claims, leads pirate site users to buy more DVDs, visit the cinema more often, and on average spend more than their honest counterparts at the box office, because they have more exposure. The users often buy a ticket at the expense of weekend days, the report notes. In the past, similar studies have revealed the same is true for music. People who pirate a lot of music buy significantly more music than those who don't, because the problem with most artists is that they're isn't that they're being pirated, is that they're too obscure and no one knows about them. Obviously, it would be of great interest to see the report in full, but it appears that it is not going to be possible. According to the anonymous GFK source, quoted by Telopolis, that the findings of the study proved so unpleasant to the company that commissioned the survey that it has now been locked away in the poison cupboard. Wow, that's a weird term. I guess they're using that now. GFK says it has a policy of not revealing who they conduct research for if their clients don't want to be exposed. However, they do carry out research for the movie industry. Telopolis go a stage further and call that work lobbying. The GFK source says that the study shows if you download films, you have an increased interest in cinema. Makes sense. Which only highlights how stupid it would be for the authorities to carry out their implied threat of prosecuting Kino.to users.
Well, you know, the thing is, the people that are, you know, going out of their way to try and find and download this stuff, they are, you know, movie files, they're audio files, you know, they're guys that are, you know, obsessed with movies and music and stuff like that. And sometimes, you know, stuff's really difficult to find. Like, I just watched the movie Stalker by Andrei Tarkovsky, which is an outstanding film. It was made in 1979 in the Soviet Union. It's kind of based off the short story Roadside Picnic. And it was part of the inspiration for the game series Stalker. Now, I found a copy of it online, and I really, really like it. I have to say, it's one of my favorite movies. And what am I going to do now? Even though I pirated it once, I'm going to go buy the DVD. Because if you make a movie that is good enough for me, that I really like, that I want to watch more than one time, I'm going to go out and buy the DVD. You know, because it's better quality, I get special features, you know, I'm going to go out and buy the DVD because I can bring it with me, you know? And I don't understand why, you know, watching something once is costing us billions and billions of dollars. No, because if you didn't have it free online, I wouldn't go watch the damn thing. Because I'm not going to go to the movie theater. I'm not going to pay $12 to watch a movie that I don't really want to see, you know? I'm not going to go watch any of these stupid, you know, romantic comedies or anything like that. I'm not going to go buy these, you know? If I'm bored and I, you know, see something online that maybe looks intriguing, and I'll watch it, you know? If it's free, then I know I didn't lose anything. And if it's good, well, I'm going to go buy the DVD, because if you made it that good, I'm going to buy it.
Now, there's something about owning a physical copy as opposed to just downloading it, which is what they don't seem to understand that whole concept of try before you buy. Now, like, I've got lots of TV series in my hard drive. Most of the ones I've kept, like, if I didn't like it, I deleted it, and that was that. Most of the ones I've kept, I either got the DVD set, or I'm in the process of buying them as I find it. And of course, a lot of these, because they're so old, I wouldn't be able to just go and buy it. They're hard to find. So the only way for me to watch is to download it. And as I find it, I pick it up one set at a time until I get the whole thing. And I know lots of people who do this. And also, it's not economical for me to buy thousands of dollars of movies at once kind of thing if I want to watch them all. So I watch them all, pick up the ones I like, buy those, and support the industry when it's giving me something I want. In OPSEC failure news, police examined bag found in bin near Rebecca Brooks' home. Now, I didn't really want to talk too much about the whole News of the World phone hacking thing, but I've got two stories that are important here. This one, Rebecca Brooks is involved in the scandal, or at least probably most likely is involved in the scandal. Detectives are examining a computer, paperwork, and phone found in the bin near the Riverside home, London home of Rebecca Brooks, the former chief executive of News International. The Guardian has learned that the bag containing the items was found in an underground car park at the Design Center at the exclusive Chelsea Harbour development on Monday afternoon. The car park, under a shopping center, is yards from the gated apartment block where Brooks lives with her husband, a former racetrack trainer and close friend of David Cameron. It is understood that the bag was handed into security around 3 p.m., and shortly afterwards, Brooks' husband, Charlie, arrived and tried to reclaim it. He was unable to prove the bag was his, and the security guard refused to release it. Instead, it is understood that the security guard called the police, which I wonder why. In less than half an hour, two marked police cars and an unmarked forensics car were said to have arrived at the scene. Police are now examining CCTV footage taken in the car parked to uncover who dropped the bag. Initial suspicions had been that there was a break-in at the Brooks flat have been dismissed. David Wilson, Charlie Brooks' official spokesperson, told the Guardian that Charlie Brooks denies the bag belonged to his wife. Charlie has a bag which contains a laptop and some papers which are private to him, said Wilson. I call that backtracking. They were nothing to do with Rebecca or the phone hacking case. Wilson said Charlie Brooks had left the bag with a friend who was returning it, but dropped it in the wrong part of the garage. When asking how the bag ended up in the bin, he replied, "The suggestion is that a cleaner thought it was rubbish and put it in the bin," Wilson added. Charlie was looking for it together with a couple of the building staff. Charlie was told that it had gone to security, by which they had already called police to say they had found something. The police took it away. Charlie's lawyers got in touch with the police to say that they could look at the computer, but they'd see that there was nothing relevant to them on it. He's expecting the stuff back forthwith. But here's a word you don't see very often anymore. Rebecca Brooks was arrested Sunday under suspicion of conspiring to intercept communications and corrupting police officers. She is due to appear before the Commons Culture, Media, and Sports Select Committee on Tuesday afternoon.
You know, just as a reminder to everybody, anything that you put in the trash can outside of your house is considered public property at that point. Anybody can come in and they can go through your trash, you know? And even if it's on private property and it's in the bin, if you don't have no trespassing signs that tell them to leave, then it's perfectly legal what they're doing. So just a reminder to everybody, just as proper, you know, OPSEC and PERSEC, please, please, please utilize burn bags or find a secure way to dispose of trash. Now, another thing is with this story, the security guard. You know, good on him. He could have just been a pushover. He could have just said, okay, no, it's no big deal. He says it's his laptop and I'll give it back to him. You know, good on him. At least, you know, this is just another reason why I think that security guards have always got a bad rap. There's a couple of bad ones, but, you know, the majority of us are pretty good to go.
I wonder about the security guard is, like, I understand why he rejected giving the bag back. That should be standard procedure for anyone who can't identify the missing object. But why did he call police? Did he know there was something with this? Did he call because it was a suspicious package, or was multiple people trying to claim it, or something like that?
What I got from the article is that there wasn't any name or anything on the bag or on the laptop or anything, so he called police to report something that was missing. You know, it's a laptop. That's something that's pretty expensive. Somebody might have filed, you know, a police report for it. You know, he just said, "Hey, I found this laptop. Can you take it?" You know. I think somebody might have had it lost or stolen. I'm thinking that's what it was, and whenever they figured out who it was that was trying to claim it and everything, I think they took it in as evidence.
So that's the case right there. Or actually, more hopefully, is the fact that somehow he found out that, like, maybe the first page in the thing was directly recording the case, in which case it's like, okay, bring this into the police. But this husband here is either a complete dumbass or was up to something, because of the fact that the bag's dropped off in a car park. Like, it's got a laptop and papers in it. Like, I don't care if your friend is dropping off. You don't drop it off in a car park. You hand it off person to person. I wouldn't leave my laptop unattended for any period of time.
And this looks like a good spot right here.
So I'm thinking either he knew what his wife was up to and decided to covertly tip off the authorities, and maybe she found out and sent him to go get it. Or he's a complete idiot and has no concept of personal security at all. Also, regarding the phone hacking scandal, in corporate conspiracy news. Now, don't worry, this is the last story I'll report on about the phone hacking, unless there's a major development, because it's all over the news. Police say no one else involved in death of phone hacking whistleblower who feared someone else had to get him. Now, for those of you who don't know, the guy who blew the whistle turned up dead not long after this whole thing came to be. The man who launched the entire phone hacking scandal had become a paranoid recluse who believed someone was out to get him. A threat has appealed, which is probably not unsupported right there. Sean Hoare was found dead at his, or Hoare, was found dead at his flat in Watford, Hertfordshire, and spent most of his last weeks was like hiding in his flat with the curtains down. The post-mortem examination revealed that there was no third-party involvement in the death. Officers are not treating the death as suspicious, although it will be several weeks before they have the full toxicology results. Well, what did he die from then? A friend and neighbor claimed Mr. Hoare, 47, had become increasingly reclusive and paranoid in recent weeks. He would talk about someone from the government coming to get him, he said. He would say to me, if anyone comes by, don't say I'm in. He was physically going downhill. He was yellow in color and wasn't looking well for the last month. He had a constant struggle with alcohol and talked to me about how much he had put his wife through. He did say something about the phone hacking, and I think it was his main worry. He had definite concerns with the media. He did mention he was paranoid and would mention conspiracy stuff, such as what? Former News of the World journalist Mr. Hoare had accused former Tory media chief Andy Coulson of lying about his role in the affair. He said that, in addition to the paper, Mr. Coulson actively encouraged his staff to intercept the calls to celebrities. It was his explosive claims last autumn that reignited the scandal and ultimately led to the tumultuous events of the past fortnight, which have shaken the political, police, and media establishments. Police were investigating the possibility he had killed himself, saying his death was not thought suspicious. His death came after, one, the Metropolitan Police was left in turmoil as counter-terrorist officer John Yates was forced to follow Commissioner Sir Paul Stevenson and resign. Two, Mr. Yates faced investigation over claims that he secured a Scotland Yard job for the daughter of hacking suspect Neil Wallace. Three, David Cameron cut short a trip to Africa, so he'll fly back to Britain today after agreeing to delay Parliament's summer break to discuss the affair. Four, London Mayor Boris Johnson, infuriated number 10 by, number 10 must be a media outlet, but by refusing to say whether the PM should quit over his job, quit over his hiring of Mr. Coulson. And five, police recovered a bag containing a computer, phone, and paperwork found in a bin near Rebecca Brooks' London home, which is the last story there. So after all this, all of a sudden he turns up dead. And they're saying it's not suspicious, but they're not saying what he died from. It's like, okay, I need a little more information there before I believe that, especially given that the police was involved.
You know, this reminds me, you know, kind of like of how you go into, like an abandoned building or some nasty place like that. You take a flashlight with you. You go into this nice dark room, you know, turn your flashlight on, click it on, and there's cockroaches, and they all freeze, and then they scatter. That's what it reminds me of, you know, here, is that these guys got caught with their pants down. The police got caught with their pants down. The government got caught with their pants down. The corporation got caught with their pants down. And now all they're trying to do is just scatter and, you know, keep as much damage under wraps as possible, you know, because now the fact that this guy's dead, it means he can't testify. So he's just another witness that is now gone, and especially with the fact that he's the main whistleblower here. Not only is it revenge, but it's also, you know, covering their asses in the future. And this really says a lot, you know, it says a lot about our culture these days, is the fact that people aren't pissed off that this is being classified as a natural death. That, you know, I'd like to see the coroner's report. Please, I'd like to see the coroner's report released as public record. And I can't believe that there isn't a little bit more outrage about this whole thing. This is like, you know, third page news about this whole thing. You know, that everybody's freaking out about Rupert Murdoch and the stupid pie thing. No, the guy is dead that started this. That's a big freaking deal.
I also like how they've got out of their way here to say that, oh, look, he was having problems. He was saying conspiracy stuff. He had an alcohol problem. I mean, all of it is relevant to police, but really, whether or not he was killed doesn't really depend on that. He obviously was under a lot of stress because he just basically took down a huge media organization, and there's lots of really, really high-end people who are going to go down for this. So he's made himself a few enemies. You would think he'd be stressed out enough to drink a little bit or get paranoid. In Taking a Stand for Freedom News, ISP refuses to block the Pirate Bay. Woohoo! Previously, representatives from the Finnish music industry filed a lawsuit against Eliza, one of the country's largest ISPs, demanding that it should block subscriber access to the Pirate Bay in a reply filed at the district court. Eliza has refused to comply, describing the blocking demands as unreasonable. During May, the Copyright Information and Anti-Piracy Center, CIAPC, and the Finnish branch of IFPI announced that they had filed a lawsuit at the district court in Helsinki. The latest in a growing line of lawsuits against service providers worldwide, the legal action demands Eliza, one of Finland's largest ISPs, should block all subscriber access to the Pirate Bay. Eliza, however, aren't going to give in so easily, which is good because they're a large one. Despite CIAPC, that are known locally as the TTBK, wow, there's a lot of acronyms here, and IFPI's claims about blocking, the Pirate Bay is the only practical solution to slow down pirates. And the IFPI's claims that blocking the Pirate Bay is the only practical solution to slow down piracy. Yeah, right. Eliza lodged a reply at the district court which rejects the demands of the music groups. While Eliza indicate that they have no fundamental objection to assisting in the fight against unlawful file sharing, Eliza's senior vice president, Panu Lehti, says the lawsuit's demands are unacceptable. The fact that the requirement to block the Pirate Bay applies to only one internet service provider is unreasonable, says Lehti. Singling out one ISP for legal action is the usual modus operandi for the entertainment industries, especially in the website blocking cases. CIAPC and IFPI selected Eliza because they have proportionally more subscribers using the Pirate Bay than any other ISP. I wonder why. Lehti says the basic censorship strategy is followed by his flawed and successfully blocking Pirate Bay would prove technically very difficult or impossible. Which is true. I mean, people use proxies, they can change their IP. I mean, really, blocking the main name wouldn't do much, and if you block the IPs, those can change. The industry groups counter by saying they have been left with no other choices after the criminal conviction of the Pirate Bay admins following their November 2010 appeal failed to close on the site. Instead, the number of Finns using the site only increased. According to the industry groups, the Pirate Bay is the preferred online location for Finns to access illicit music. This makes it one of the most popular sites in the country, and one which has broken into the top 30 most visited websites. Wow, so basically the whole country is in on this, and they think that shutting it down is going to stop piracy? Good luck. The development of legitimate online marketing in Finland will not be successful if illegal services such as Pirate Bay can continue to operate, says producer representative Lori Richard. Which is bullshit, because look at iTunes. iTunes is one of the most successful music sales programs ever, and it exists up here in Canada, in the US, where file sharing is pretty abundant. Others believe the reverse is true, i.e. build legal services and they shall come, which is true. This week, John Legeroff, I can't pronounce that, CEO and co-founder of the X5 Music Group in Sweden, has been speaking about the success enjoyed by Spotify, the pirate-killing service, which has just launched in the US. Spotify has had the biggest impact on the Scandinavian music market since the launch of CD, Legeroff told Hypebot in the Q&A. Spotify is currently the biggest single revenue source for the music industry, and is estimated to be over three times bigger than iTunes in Scandinavia. Digital downloads grew 17% last year compared to 3% in the US. Piracy for music has almost stopped, which is true. I mean, you like music, you go buy it. You know, piracy is a temporary thing.
Piracy is a temporary thing up to a point, you know? And again, you know, it comes to an issue, you know, I'm a security guard, I'm a student, I don't have the money to be shilling at $20 for a CD at a time, you know? So if I find a band that I like, I try and buy their CDs, you know? And maybe I'll buy one CD, but I'll download their discography, because again, I can't afford to spend, you know, $200 on, you know, six CDs. So I think that this whole thing with piracy is just ignorance, you know? Oh, we're losing money. Yeah, but you're getting exposure, you know, for free. It really does make a big deal, you know, and the more that I'm able to access free music, the more music I listen to, you know, which means the more CDs that I buy. And this goes back, you know, to the whole thing with the movies and stuff. It's the same thing. I don't have the money for all this stuff. I'm a college student. Who listens to the most music, I would say? I'd have to say it's teenagers and college students. So, all these people wouldn't be buying any music, any CDs, wouldn't be going to concerts, wouldn't know about any of these bands, and all that they can bitch about is their profits. This is just, it's ignorant, it's stupid, and I think that we should just legalize piracy, say, sorry, this is the way it is, deal with it.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I mean, the problem for most bands, I heard this on some interview, I can't remember with who, the problem with most bands is that, not that they're being pirated, it's that they have no exposure. Oh, the music industry doesn't want us to go to a digital media because that cuts them out. If releases on CDs in big stores only happens if you're on a record label or are already huge, and you can't become huge like that unless you're on a record label. So they skim a lot of profit off that, selling actual physical CDs and stuff like that through these big box stores. Now, of course, people like me and probably most people listen to a lot of alternative music that's not in the mainstream. It's really hard to go to a music store and find stuff you like and listen to it, like they have this listening booth there. So the only way for me to find this music is to go download it, and if I like it, buy it in a digital form or off the artist's website. All the money, or almost all the money, goes to the artist. I feel way better about that than buying a CD in a store. In Oh My God, What the Fuck news, University of Hawaii professor proposes to make child porn legal to protect children. In a development sure to make saddest pony up their blog machine, that doesn't make any sense at all. Professor Milton Diamond of the University of Hawaii has proposed that artificial child porn may be available for perverts following research published online Wednesday in the Springer's Journal Archives of Sexual Behavior, which, according to Daily Mail, suggests that child sex crimes fell when child pornography was made more easily accessible. Now, I just like to be clear, I don't know what he means by artificial, because, I mean, if he means, like, cartoon or adults who look like kids, I mean, that most places that's already legal, so I don't know what he's proposing here. According to the researchers, who specifically studied how decriminalizing possession of all pornography, American Apparel ads and child porn included, affected society in the Czech Republic after a 50-year ban was lifted when the country transitioned to democracy in 1990. As with adult pornography appearing to substitute for sexual aggression everywhere has been investigated, we believe the availability of child porn does similarly. But, you know, at what cost? But shouldn't we take into account that, in general, models of legal age are both giving consent and are getting paid in choosing how to show up their new set of fake tits in adult porn flicks? While children abused during the making of underage pornography are often too young to know what's happening and too overpowered to escape their abusers. Probably between bouts of totally grinding sick swells, now keep in mind this is from a blog, not an actual news site, that's why it's got so much editorial here, and trolling online image boards, the team also noted a similar trend in both Denmark and Japan, where child abuse becomes less prevalent in those countries after they lift their own bans on possessing kiddie skin flicks. At least in Japan, making or distributing remained illegal. So it doesn't really matter where it comes from, as long as it's not from our country, I guess. Diamond, it seems, would intend to do the same by ensuring that everyone turning Japanese to decriminalize underage porn is seeing something artificial. However, just what that would entail and who would be charged with making this stuff still seems unclear.
No. The way that I kind of judge this is, again, if it's an adult that's made it to look like a kid, or what have you, you know, and they're doing role play, that's perfectly fine. If there's an actual kid that is getting hurt, I don't care if it, you know, drawings don't fall under this, any your books don't fall under this, but if there's an actual kid being hurt by this, then I think it should be made illegal, and hopefully I can, you know, bash your head with a freaking stick. But, I think that we need to draw a line with this, you know? And we should draw the line at, are people being hurt by this? Are people being physically hurt by this? You know, or emotionally hurt by this? I think we should draw the line at that. You know, regardless of what happens between two consensual adults, that's one thing. What happens to a kid is a completely other thing, you know? Like I said, I have no problem with books being made legal. I have no problem with, you know, drawings being made legal. I have no problem with role-playing being made legal. What I draw the line at is people being hurt. And I think that, you know, essentially saying it's okay to hurt kids is completely sickening to me. I would stand up and I would fight against that tooth and nail.
I have a similar stance. If there's no actual children involved, whether it be, you know, CG or some shit like that, if there's no actual children involved, I have no problem with it. There's no one being hurt. Like, I find it distasteful, of course, but no one's being hurt, so I don't really have an opinion on it anymore. However, basically this guy's proposing here, and I think this, he might mean, like, actual artificial, like, no people involved, but that doesn't make sense to me since it's already illegal in most places to do that. If he's proposing that we stage child pornography in like a safer environment, whatever, then basically you're weighing the rights against the actual rights of one child against the potential rights of a bunch of others. I mean, that's literally going, okay, well, there's five people going to die here, and there's one person with five healthy organs. So let's harvest him and save five people. You know, no, you can't go, this one person out is less important than all these other people. We need to protect all children. And so this seems ridiculous to me if that's what he's proposing here, because of the fact that, you know, sure, it might actually eliminate some of this abuse in the real world, but it's still not acceptable to do that. We need to protect them all. We need to crack down the abuse, not give them a different way of abusing people that we deem less harmful.
One thing, you know, I see here is, again, with these studies, is they don't take into account personal responsibility. Predators aren't going to stop being predators because they have easy access to pornography. That's just not the way it is. They're not predators because they don't have easy access to porn. They're predators because they're predators, you know? Regardless of what causes that, these people are making conscious decisions to hurt others. You know, that's not going to rely on what pornography is available. That's, you know, regardless of the person making a conscious choice to hurt another person.
Sure, take responsibility for your own actions. In Stay in Your Homes, Remain Calm news. Lawyers say Gould, I love that word because, you know, Stargate, Gould ordinances violate Constitution. Gould, Arizona. I couldn't believe that it was real when I first read it, said UALR School of Law Dean John DePipa. This, incidentally, it doesn't say until later in the article, but I'm going to say it now. Basically, it created a law saying that people can't gather at all, like two people can't get together. It's ridiculous. But the truth is, the city of Gould doesn't have the authority to tell anyone that they have no right to petition them, no right to speak, and no right to exist in their city, said DePipa. But that's just what the ordinances do, disbanding a citizens group, forbidding the mayor from meeting with people, and stopping groups from forming if members discuss the city council without council approval. The fact is, if it's aimed at this group, it also extends to you when you're talking to your mother, at church group, or any other group that wants to form. A garden club is so broad, you can't possibly comply with the First Amendment, said DePipa. Pretty clearly, they go way beyond what is necessary or what is lawful, said Council Mark Hayes with the Arkansas Municipal League. That's even what the Gould City Attorney told the council. So their own lawyers turned around and said, like, look, you can't do this. In return, the members tried to fire him. That's why you have a higher court, said council member Sonia Farley. To keep order when people can't keep order. That's why you have a council. Wow, you're full of yourself there. But this with the city council, it's their way or the highway, said Gould Mayor Ernest Nash. They act more like Napoleon Bonaparte, told Domination. Wow, they even usurped the mayor? That's crazy. The goal of the ordinances is to relieve friction between city leaders and groups, but the mayor argues that it's a false problem to write in an ordinance. This group doesn't cause friction between me and the council. The council causes friction between me and the council, he said. Unfortunately, it's probably going to lead to a lawsuit, embarrassment, and expense to the city of Gould because it has no chance of being upheld in court, said the PIPA, adding, according to the ordinance, the conversations Fox 16 had with the mayor, council members, and the Gould City Advisory Council Commission on Wednesday against the law. Technically, when they met with you, they violated their own ordinance, said the PIPA. The mayor says he believes the council is purposely trying to lose the city's charter, and he doesn't know why. In June, he struggled against council members voting against accepting an $800,000 grant to repair the city's sewage system. Nash says it was beginning of his rocky relationship with certain council members. I say the councilors are being taken over by the Gould.
I think what needs to happen here is the people of this town need to go down to the city hall, or the council hall, or wherever the hell this is. They need to go down with some pitchforks and some torches, and they need to march in there and completely, you know, kick every single one of those city council members out. They are gone. They are no longer part of the city council. We are disbanding the city council as of right now, and we're voting in some new ones, because this is just absolutely ridiculous. Anybody that agrees with this obviously hasn't read the Constitution or have any idea of what the Constitution is essentially putting forth in its ideas of what this country was founded upon. This is absolutely ridiculous. You're telling me that you're not allowing two people to meet up and speak about anything political or otherwise. That's, like, this is something that you'd see in, like, China or something like that. Not here in the United States, where we have, you know, very clear-cut First Amendment rights.
This legislation here is so broad that what they need to do, because these are small towns with usually tight-knit communities, and the cop is part of the town kind of thing, they usually have a cop in the town, they need to get that cop, go to the next city councilor meeting, and arrest all of them for violating their own ordinance, just to see what they do.
Oh, hell yeah. That would be the biggest slap in the face.
Of course, that's not the only problem that they're having down in the States. In Balkanization news, thanks to Fat Ninja for this one. 51st state, California politician pushes secession plan. A conservative, I'd like to add that Fat Ninja commented on this, saying that if this actually passes, then it will basically balkanize all of California, because a whole bunch of other organizations are going to get together and do the same thing, and basically split up California into a bunch of little micro states. A conservative county supervisor in Southern California wants to form the 51st state by seceding from the region from California, saying the state's problems require radical solutions. Listen, I knew I'd be criticized, and I learned in my tenure of being a politician for 19 years, sometimes you have to do radical things to get people's attention, Riverside County Supervisor Jeff Stone said to CNN Thursday. We hit a bit of a nerve with citizens who are just fed up with business as usual in this state, Stone said. I'm talking about a secession plan from the state of California. This week, the Riverside County Board of Supervisors gave the okay for Stone to hold a summit of California's local leaders to discuss remedies for the state's long list of woes, including secession. But the county board stopped short of endorsing Stone's secession plan by insisting no taxpayer money be used for the conference. Stone has come up with a name for the new state, South California. That's creative. It would be composed of 13 largely Republican counties, most of which are inland among the Nevada and Arizona state lines. The plan would include Los Angeles County, but would exclude Los Angeles County, but would include Orange and San Diego counties, both on the coast. Stone has a long list of grievances against the state and its legislatures: high taxes and fees, inability to reform welfare programs, high unemployment, and excessive regulations, which, as we all know, California has some pretty crazy regulatory laws. What the state has done is they've been balancing their budgets on the backs of our local coffers. They've been stealing our sales tax, property tax, Stone said. The bottom line for me and my constituents is jobs. We are sending jobs out of the state of California by the trainload. Riverside County is amongst the hardest hit communities by the recession and the mortgage meltdown, leaving many communities pockmarked with vacant homes, Stone said. We are the foreclosure capital of the world, Stone asserted. We have some areas of the county that have 25% unemployment, and the average Riverside County is about 15%. Stone's plan seems a long shot, one analyst said. There are at least 27 efforts for secession within parts of California since the 1800s, and none has been successful. Robert Melsch, a political science instructor at Mount San Jacinto College in San Jacinto, California, which is in Riverside County, said Stone's plan stunned him, largely because of the high cost of putting the secessionist plan before the voters. He called it a scare tactic. Insanity, Mel said. I mean, this is a major surgery where we need a Band-Aid. But I think you need a little more than a Band-Aid there, guys. That's some pretty crazy laws down there. It takes millions of dollars to get the signatures necessary to put up an initiative, Melsch added. Melsch also raised the question of getting the 51st state's government up and running. Where is he going to put the capital? Disneyland? Melsch said, which I think is kind of a stupid thing to worry about. You have some major cities you can work with there. Stone, a pharmacist and owner of an innovative compounding pharmacy, said he drew the lines for a new state up to 13 counties that were contiguous and fiscally conservative and moderate. A date for the summit of local leaders had to be scheduled, he said, which I really don't think they're looking at how much effort they're going to need to put in to actually get a 51st state working properly.
So if these guys can seriously get the votes from all of these counties and get majority votes from all these counties, I really don't have a problem with that. You know, I think that if you have an issue with the area that you're in, you know, instead of just leaving and you have the ability and the resources and you're willing to put in the time to try and do something like this, go right ahead. You know, how do you think this happened all in the first place? Because people got fed up with the government and fed up with what was happening, and that's how this country was formed, you know? And if you're able to do this peacefully and you're able to do it correctly, you're not screwing people over, I think there should be no problem with this.
It really depends on if they have a game plan on how to actually deal with succession, because of the fact that, like, as we all know, Quebec's been trying to break off for years, or at least a small part of Quebec has been rallying to break off of Canada for years. But they really have no game plan for what happens if it actually succeeded. They may be able to set up a government, but they don't have any idea of how they get resources, you know, how they would control their borders and stuff like that. So I'm looking at this and going, you know, this has got the same problem, you know, try some barbershop conversation here going, you know what would be a good idea? We broke off, you know, everyone has these conversations now and then, but these guys are taking a little too far. You guys need to finish your planning first and figure out an actual game plan to get your whole government up and running and make sure you don't, you know, collapse the moment you succeed if you do.
You know, I agree completely with that. I think that they need to, if they're going to be serious about this, they need to pull their heads out of their asses and they need to just take it seriously. They got to understand what the real issues are. You know, they need to talk to a whole bunch of different governors and stuff like that and see what issues they deal with, you know, on a daily basis. And stuff that, and look at history and see what's happened with countries that have seceded from other countries, states that have seceded from other states. I mean, and a great one would be to look at some of the examples that's in the Civil War. That's the biggest, you know, state secession movement that I can personally think of. So they need to understand the issues of what happened here. And I don't think this is going to turn into a military conflict. Obviously, if they do end up taking it that far, but I think that there really shouldn't be a problem with them trying to do this. I don't think that they should be looked down upon for it, but what I think they need to do is they need to get some proper goal-oriented individuals, they need to figure out what the hell it actually they need to do, and be serious about it, not half-assed about it.
For sure.
Okay, now moving on into Wrecked Media. What we have here is the Battle of Blair Mountain, thanks to Jules Verboven. This is a documentary about the largest class war in America between miners and coal mining companies. It's an important piece of history that has been largely covered up and forgotten. This is, you know, really interesting. It's just a YouTube link here. Check it out. Also, thanks to Jules Verboven, is Brzezinski is the story of a medical director and PhD biochemist named Dr. Stanislaw Brzezinski, who won the largest and possibly most convoluted, intriguing legal battle against the Food and Drug Administration in American history. And again, this is interesting. You know, this is a free link here. Check it out. Always good stuff. Now, for the Cyberpunk kit, what we have today is the Revision Eyewear Alpha Wing Sport Metal Sunglasses. These are made by the company Revision, which makes a whole bunch of safety eyewear for the U.S. military. And what essentially these are is these are, you know, your Ray-Ban style aviator glasses that are, I believe, ANSI Z80. They meet the protocols for that. So these are essentially, you know, like ballistics. I don't think these are ballistic. These are safety glasses that look like really nice, high-end aviator glasses. They look real nice. You know, you can get them in nice mirror shades. And eye protection is always a good thing.
Oh, yeah. I love military-specced eyeglasses or eyewear. I mean, you've seen some of those where it's like, take a shotgun to the face, which I wouldn't want to take a shotgun to the face, but if I did, I'd want to be wearing glasses when it happened.
What I actually saw is I saw a picture of a Marine over in Iraq who was wearing a pair of ESS Ice 2.4s, which is what I wear, and he was at the range in Iraq, took a ricochet right to the left lens, it bounced off the lens, went down, deflected, cut his nose, cut his lip, and that was it. And he took a, you know, direct ricochet right to the glass. You know, that's quite a lot of force, because it really messed up the glasses, but it saved his eye. It would have hit him right in the eye and possibly could have killed him. Now, for our daily hack, is we have a teenager that built an earthquake warning system. A Chilean teen tweets about earthquakes better than his whole government. If I were caught in an earthquake, I'd be pretty shell-shocked. But Sebastian Allegra, a 14-year-old Chilean high school student, decided to hack together a Twitter alert system that's already a year ahead of the Chilean government's own planned project. Allegria's rudimentary yet effective system comes from having survived Chile's own earthquakes last year and seeing the devastation that covered Japan earlier this year. Keen on finding an inexpensive solution for early earthquake detection, he rigged an Arduino and domestic earthquake detector to tweet seconds before detectable seismic activity, tweeting from Alarma Seismos, ALARMASISMOS, if you want to check that out on Twitter. It has already successfully detected every major earthquake that can be felt from Santiago since May, and is piling on the Twitter followers. The only thing he has left to do is expand the project. He plans on deploying more sensors throughout the country, and is even working with carriers to start sending texts to people. Having the government help him might not hurt a bit either.
This is very cool. I love this innovation, especially since he's 14. 14. It basically, his teenager slapped together a system. Like literally just slap together, just grab some parts, slap together, and made a system that works as well as some countries' early warning systems. And it gives like, you know, 10 to 30 seconds, depending on where you are in the country, of warning. So if he can get these spread over the whole country, you know, more power to him. I hope he goes forward with this and gets a career in seismology or something like that. You know, he should definitely get something for doing this, because this helps out his country and his fellow people immensely.
You know, and again, this just goes along with the whole thing that we had a couple of weeks ago with a whole bunch of, you know, the DIY equipment that was being built by people in the military for people in the military that is really helping these guys out, you know, and stuff like this is really where the advancement of technology is happening these days. You know, it's a lot of the DIY stuff that's being done for, you know, a pittance. These guys are not making any money off of it right now. And they're making stuff that works better than a whole bunch of these other freaking, you know, major organizations that are spending millions and billions of dollars. You know, it's kind of like the whole thing, what we should do with NASA. I think we should just completely, you know, open source, crowdsource NASA. And, you know, what we could do is get the Minecraft crowd involved. You know, you want to make some cool shit, let's get these guys involved. And we need to really start bringing it back to the roots, so you don't need money to do this. You can contribute your ideas, you can come up with ideas, and you can put them out there, and somebody will freaking listen to you.
Definitely, definitely. I totally support that, and really, we have some resources here, which is a bunch of people who are not in any kind of field, who are just good at innovating, and we're not using that resource. But don't worry, we'll be back next week to make sure you can get the news you need to survive. If you cannot contribute to the show, please distribute it. We would like to thank the Army of Flying Monkeys for their assistance in gathering data. If you have any news stories or pertinent information you want to send us, you can reach us at news@rostudios.org. That's news@rostudios.org. If you like the music in the background, check out People of Earth by Dr. Steele. And our fade-out track will be something from that album. I'll just pick something out. Remember, everyone, we cannot defeat the enemy if we are at each other's throats. So until next time, that's what Server said. End of line.